This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. From Russia's incursion into Ukraine and the collapse of the Russian currency to the ongoing crisis in the Middle East to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and independence votes in Scotland and Catalonia, it's been a typically busy year on the foreign affairs scene.
Secretary of State John Kerry has logged plenty of frequent flyer miles, and other diplomats have been well-traveled as well. Lake Effect contributor Art Sear doesn't have to log quite so much miles. He only has to make the trip up I-94 from Carthage College in Kenosha. He's done that throughout the year, and he joins us now with a recap. Hello, Art. Great to see you.
It's always nice to be with you and colleagues here.
Well, it has been quite a year in foreign affairs. 2014 will go down in the books, I think, with lots of really interesting things happening, including one that's very, very recent, which is normalization with relations with Cuba.
Yeah.
I mean, some people would say that's a long time coming, but what are the implications of this? It's huge.
Well, I think it was the right move to make, and in fact, it's overdue. But given domestic political pressures in the U.S., it's understandable. And I do think the president, even after a half century of rigid relations or lack of relations with Cuba, deserves credit for taking a move that's clearly daring in political and in terms of public support. It's a unique and distinctive relationship with Cuba. The trauma of having a communist satellite appear pretty quickly from the viewpoint of most Americans around 1960 was literally shocking and created a political earthquake in this country, which continues to reverberate. I think the positive aspects of diplomatic relations are the same that apply in our relations with other countries in the world, including the Soviet Union and China during the height of the Cold War. It provides an opportunity for us to enter our positive influence in what remains a police state. It permits us to pursue not only human rights causes, but also economic, trade, and investment, which, as the Soviet Union demonstrates, and I believe China is demonstrating, at least opens up a dictatorship and can bring it down.
Do you think the fact that Fidel was essentially out of the picture and Raul took over made this possible from President Obama's perspective?
I doubt that. The brothers are very close. Raul Castro was and is the principal enforcer for his brother. He's the one who carried out the truly shocking criminal mass executions after the revolutionaries took power at the beginning of 1959, and he remains in charge of the police state in terms of the security apparatus as well as the military. I do think with age and time and the end of the Cold War, earlier passions have faded. But you're quite right. On both sides, it was a very passionate, intense hatred, particularly during the Kennedy administration, when things in many different ways seemed to get out of hand.
So what does normalization of relations mean in practical terms? What are we looking at in terms of travel and economic trade? What kinds of things are going to change?
The embargo is still in place. And the embargo that was one of President Eisenhower's last acts in January 1961 has been very, very rigid and very, very strictly enforced by the U.S. The problem is that literally no other country in the world, not Canada, not Britain, not anyone among our allies, with the exception of Israel, and our Israeli friends deserve a lot of credit for sticking with us. A couple of small island countries nobody's heard of, no disrespect, in the Caribbean and the Pacific have occasionally supported the U.S., but we've been very much alone. The only way to get an embargo to work, and it's very hard to make them work, is to make sure you have a consensus, and we've had no consensus in terms of the embargo. Congress still has to act if we're going to lift the embargo, as the president pointed out in his important address announcing normalization of relations, and that's going to be a very bitter battle, I'm sure. Marco Rubio from Florida, which is especially important politically, domestically, and in our relations with Cuba, has already denounced President Obama in rather startling personal terms. In practical terms, though, exchange relationships, multinational corporations that even if U.S. chartered have lots of ways of getting around embargoes, they now have a green light to invest in and trade with Cuba, and the Cubans desperately need this. I'm quite confident that Fidel and Raul have not changed their stripes, but the ramshackle, increasingly desperate straits of the Cuban economy has forced them to compromise their ideology.
Moving to another topic, ISIS, the rise of ISIS and global terrorism. This was a big, big news story this past year and probably will continue to be.
Mm-hmm. It certainly has been. And the very brutal nature and the almost unbelievably sadistic and criminal nature of the ISIS movement has made it a natural in this 24/7 video news age to get a lot of publicity and attention. They are a significant threat, especially to the people immediately in the region. However, and this is an important however, given the media emphasis and, I believe, exaggeration on the nature of their threat, it's extremely important to pay attention to what kinds of assets and what kinds of strategic effectiveness these fanatics really have.
And in your opinion, what strategic assets do they have?
Very little. They don't really have heavy weapons. They've been able to take over some limited territories in Syria and Iraq, but they are very limited. They certainly do not have the kind of popular support that's crucial to the success of any revolutionary movement that was key, for instance, to the ultimate success of the very determined and very smart revolutionaries during the long Indochina wars, including our Vietnam War. There's no evidence that they have that. They have been fairly easy to push back as long as we had support on the ground. Along with looking to what they actually seem to have in the way of support and assets, it's important to pay attention to Turkey, which along with Israel is our only real ally in the region. Relationships with each of these allies are very challenging. But overall, I think, and this is most important, the struggle with ISIS has reinforced our traditional very strong bonds with Turkey. The Turks have been forced to be flexible in dealing with the Kurdish minority, which is understandably viewed as a separatist threat to Turkey. They've collaborated with Kurdish ground forces in the fight against ISIS, and they've had to restrain some of the more extreme sentiments toward a minority that does shelter its own extremist movement. My kind of rambling discussion here gets at the fact that these are very, very complicated relationships, and again, for superficial commercial media, not public radio or television, it's made to order, I think, to increase public anxiety and fear without actually realistically reporting on what's going on.
Well, that leads into the Middle East in general, talking about Turkey, talking about Israel, Palestine. Syria is ongoing. Things still happening in Egypt. What is your take on this past year in the Middle East?
I think in many ways it's positive, believe it or not. In Egypt, the military did reimpose, there was a military takeover, throwing out the Arab Brotherhood. The long-term trend, however, in the region, especially starting in Algeria and Morocco about a decade ago, has been very positive in the sense that there are more and more popular movements toward representation. Samuel Huntington of Harvard University, a very distinguished academic who also had policy experience, wrote a book called The Clash of Civilizations, which became a bestseller, especially after 9/11. In that book, he made the point that there are fundamental cultural differences between different populations in the world, including between Islam and the West. Another book, however, that he wrote earlier on in the early 90s called The Third Wave developed a theme that's at least as important and perhaps more important. Starting with the French and American revolutions, there's been a broad popular, now global movement toward democracy and representative government. He argues that this was interrupted twice, but in 74, starting with the overthrow of the military in Greece and Portugal, he wrote that a third wave toward democracy really became strongly launched, and I think the turmoil in North Africa as well as the Middle East reflects this. If you're really serious about understanding what's going on, I would really urge taking a look at the third wave. It's as timely as ever.
A lot of people would say that thrust towards democracy and that thrust towards representative government took some hits in the Middle East.
Absolutely.
This past year. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, revolutions are violent. The American and French Revolution were violent experiences. And I believe, echoing Huntington, that both world wars, these terrible, unprecedented bloodbaths of the 20th century, reflected in part the tremendous turmoil. Not only the destructiveness of modern technology, but the tremendous turmoil that technology brings to economic development.
Staying in that region, kind of, sort of, Russia has been a huge player. There's been all kinds of things going on with Russia and with Vladimir Putin. Your impressions on that?
Again, I think in many ways it's very positive. Historically, Russia has had an intense desire, an emotional necessity of having sympathetic regimes on their western border. After World War II, in the wake of Barbarossa, this gigantic, almost unbelievably enormous invasion of the Soviet Union by the Wehrmacht in 1941, and the colossal scale of that total war on the Eastern Front, the Soviets became downright paranoid about having sympathetic regimes on their western border. And whether it's the Bush administration regarding Georgia or the Obama administration regarding Ukraine, we're seeing that traditional nationalism and anxiety reasserting itself. I'm not defending what Putin has done in either case. However, I don't believe he's the next Adolf Hitler, and he has, in fact, it's unacceptable in legal terms, but he has, in fact, been rather cautious in terms of what he's done in use of military force in that part of the world generally. He also has to face economic reality, getting back to the sort of fundamental importance of economic developments and misdevelopments. The Russian economy is very weak. The ruble has been plummeting. It must gall him considerably that he's had to seek out Khodorkovsky, one of the very successful and very challenging oligarchs, capitalists, who most of whom are Jewish, who have had enormous success in post-communist Russia. Khodorkovsky has just been released from house arrest. I'm sure Putin would have liked to, frankly, get rid of him completely, but he just couldn't do that in the current system. And he has to work with him and these other people that he doesn't like because of the tremendous economic resources they control. The Russian economy continues to go downhill, but Khodorkovsky's firm is doing quite well. And as long as there are opportunities to make money, the great thing about capitalism is the capitalists will be there with their capital.
You talk about the economy in Russia. I know there have been talk of more sanctions against Russia by the Obama administration. What is your take on that?
I think they have a limited effect in terms of the trouble with dealing with allies is that it's inherently difficult. Churchill liked to say that the only thing worse than trying to work with allies is not having any allies at all. I think the Obama administration would like to have been more forceful, but they couldn't get the Europeans to go along with us. I do think the degree to which the U.S. and Germany can work together. After referring to World War II, Germany is one of the most positive, I think, political and social as well as economic forces in the current world. I'm a great fan of Angela Merkel, the long-term, I believe, very successful chancellor who has challenged German history and personifies, as well as pursuing policies that are extremely – she personifies the best, I think, in terms of modern democracy. Again, I would pay attention to how well the U.S.-German relationship is going. Another big factor, not exactly celebrated on public radio and television, is fracking. The U.S. is rapidly becoming a net oil exporter. We're not there yet, but with tremendous speed, we're getting there. That's a status we haven't had since 1960. And given the vital importance of oil and natural gas for Russia's national economy, the tremendous growth in our economic strength and leverage in this area will provide us with tremendous political leverage vis-a-vis Russia. And it will not only strengthen our relationship with Germany, but also with Turkey, which is an extremely important transshipment area that may become, I hope it becomes even more important as this oil and natural gas revolution unfolds.
Well, in terms of, we have only a few minutes left, and I want to look forward. What do you think are going to be some of the big stories, the big international stories in the first months of the new year?
That's the toughest question. We professors are very good at predicting the past, but not so good, even worse than other people, some would say, about predicting the future. As far as I can see into my murky crystal ball, I think that East Asia will continue to grow in not only economic importance but political importance. And because we're so preoccupied and kind of obsessed with China today and far more worried than I think we should be, Japan and South Korea, which continues to be one of our most important allies in the world and a tremendous success story for the Korean people, as well as the U.S. government. I think countries outside of China, including finally Southeast Asia, which includes Vietnam, where economic growth is steadily increasing, I'd pay more attention to that and less attention to what's going on in the Middle East.
Art Sear, it's always a pleasure. Happy New Year, and thanks for being here.
Happy New Year to you.
Art Sear is professor of political economy and world business and the director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's also our regular foreign policy contributor.
Coming up next on the program, what happens when the material you use to make your art changes its properties over time? The next episode of Radio Chipstone explores that question when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.